Today on The Takeaway, we're continuing our Justice Delayed series with a focus on the foster care system.
He knows he has other friends that have been adopted, and so he wants to know what takes so long. And I said, well, until the judge can decide, you know, things just don't happen.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today for Wednesday, September 23rd, how the backlog in court cases has left foster families in limbo. Plus, the United States surpassed 200,000 documented deaths from COVID-19 this week. And we'll have some of your remembrances reminding us that the massive number is made up of real people.
One of my best friends, love you, I miss you.
My grandpa was so tough. He caught COVID and it killed him.
He was brilliant and devoted and funny and a loving brother, son, and father. That's what I would want people to remember.
Plus, we talk more about the Justice Ginsburg legacy as it pertains to race. But first, every year, hundreds of thousands of children enter or exit the foster system. But as courts across the country began to shutter due to COVID-19, family court proceedings in many states were delayed, and in some cases, ground to a halt. And that has trapped many foster kids and their parents in a kind of a legal limbo, like Ivy Warwick in Washington State.
My husband and I have been foster parents for almost 10 years.
Like many foster parents, Ivy relies on regular hearings to work towards a resolution of her family's case.
When it comes to the predictability of court dates and timelines, paperwork being filed, it has really been set back in Washington State. So I'm just really worried that that is going to set the case back further, even further into next year, possibly middle of next year, and just not really seeing any light in the end of the tunnel.
For the next part of our series, Justice Delayed, which examines how COVID-19 has affected our judicial system, we're going to take a look at how the pandemic has affected the family court system, specifically foster care families. I'm now going to turn to Betsy Kramer, an attorney and director of policy and special litigation at Lawyers for Children in New York
City. Resource or discharge to adult independent living. Without permanency hearings, children can't return home to their families, they can't be adopted, and they can't be placed in the custody of some other relative or family member or friend who comes forward to care for them.
John, when COVID-19 hit, how did that exacerbate some of the issues in the foster care system that already existed before the pandemic hit?
Yes. So, you know, as Betsy mentioned, you know, a lot of child welfare cases kind of play out on two tracks in the community via the child welfare agencies and then in the courts. And really in both cases, both systems, what we reported in most states was that early on in the pandemic, the decision was made to keep the front end open and greatly limit much of the rest of the activity. So that meant that investigations into reported abuse or neglect continued as usual. And in the courts, the hearings continued to decide whether or not a removal to foster care was appropriate. But a lot of those periodic checks and permanency hearings that went that are supposed to be part of a child welfare case, especially after a youth is placed into foster care, either were delayed or relegated to remote, but very often were delayed. And that includes lots of things like services rendered to families to keep them together, services meant to help facilitate the reunification of families, family time, visits between foster youth and parents or siblings. These were all made extremely difficult by the simple fact that society was shutting down to some extent. And a lot of the things that child welfare relies on to operate are in-person services and events that just were not held.
Betsy, in cases that require more, I guess, priority, if there is a child who is in danger, if there's an emergency, do those cases or have those cases sort of been prioritized, or have those cases also been caught in this sort of slow grinding to a halt?
So cases that are determined to be emergencies have been given priority. Cases where, you know, the life or health of a child is at stake are being given priority and heard by the courts. But from a child's point of view, and a child who is in foster care and is waiting to be reunited with their family, or even waiting to have more expansive visits with their family, and for whom that question is dependent on court action, that should be a priority. You know, time moves very differently for children. A young child who's been removed from their family experiences a six-month delay much differently than an adult experiences a six-month delay. So, and, you know, the long-term impact of children spending time in foster care can be harmful to children. And so all of these cases really need to be treated as emergencies and with priority.
John, we're examining sort of how different parts of the judicial system have been backed up because of COVID-19. When you look at the picture nationally for foster care cases specifically, are there regions where things are piling up even more than others? Are there specific areas that are really backed up?
Well, I think that what Betsy pointed, kind of honed in on there, I think was the most common point of anguish among a lot of different regions as we started to report on, okay, what's going on here in the early months. It's family time. It's facilitating time for these children to be with their parents if they're in foster care. Because a big expectation of the child welfare process, the expectation is if you remove a child into foster care, that the system is going to make efforts to reunify the family. And nothing is more important to that than the time they are allowed to spend together. And so it was quite quickly a point of contention or a problem in a lot of regions as this started. We found that to be the case in California. New York kind of instructed early on that, you know, family time was to continue happening. You know, our reporting months later was that in a lot of cases it did not. In Illinois, the public defender in Chicago actually sued DCFS in Illinois because they had a blanket ban on supervised visits between parents and children. So I think that particular aspect really stood out as the one that was common around the country where there was a real halting of a service where everybody agreed that was extremely not optimal.
And John, have there been any cases where some states have adapted their foster care programs to meet the challenges of COVID-19 in a good way?
Well, I think that over the last several months, more states have been able to acquire and deploy more technology to facilitate the many virtual things that need to happen now. And I think a lot of systems were probably caught unaware of the need they were going to have tablets and phone devices and things to give to families for visiting time, to the courts to facilitate hearings, and to foster youth. Many of whom are on college campuses and need to continue education.
Betsy, with the courts being closed or slowly starting to reopen, and we know that that's going to take a while as well, even with the use in some areas of video equipment, there's still many foster care families that have to make some sort of informal agreement to address some of the ongoing issues. Are those successful? Are those adequate?
They can be helpful, but they're not adequate because in many cases, the foster family and the agency overseeing the foster care placement and the family can't agree on what should happen and what is appropriate and what is needed. And that's why we have the courts to make decisions when people can't agree. And there are also certain steps that just can't be taken without the courts. A child can't be reunited with their family if there has been a court order mandating that there be supervised visits only. Without court approval, you can't move to unsupervised visits, although everybody might be ready for unsupervised visits. You can't adopt a child without a court order. So while informal agreements are helpful in some cases, and there has been a great effort for all of the players to work collaboratively, we need the courts to be functioning to really help kids in foster care move forward.
And Betsy, one of the interesting data points in this moment is that reports of child abuse have dropped during the pandemic. Why is that? Do we know?
So the vast majority of reports are made by schools, doctors, and other service providers who are seeing children in the community regularly. And because that contact has been greatly reduced, the number of reports has been reduced.
John, there are a number of lawsuits that have been brought against different states' responses to the pandemic. Can you tell us what some of the major ones are and sort of what the allegations are?
Well, I would say that there's one in particular that we've reported on, and I mentioned it before. This is the litigation that Illinois brought against DCFS, which specifically challenged a blanket policy related to COVID. DCFS came and said, no supervised visits will happen. They're not safe. And that policy went on for months. And the public defenders in Cook County challenged that, saying this needs to be something that's determined on a case-by-case basis. And that over time, while it might have been a forgivable position to take when really nobody knew what was going to go on with coronavirus, you have to start moving towards normalcy again in the process. As far as other litigation, I'm not aware of a ton that's specifically about COVID, but there are certainly ongoing class action lawsuits and litigation that has been settled against many states' child welfare systems. There's quite a few states where it's ongoing. And in the states that have settled their litigation and are trying to meet particular benchmarks, I think there's no doubt that COVID-19 and the restraints put on systems has added an extra challenge to meeting those.
Betsy, family courts are attempting to reopen in some parts of the country. What do we see going forward in terms of the backlog right now and cases being heard? You know, with the slowdown here, I feel like there are lots of kids and parents who are going to be continuing to be in that limbo.
You're absolutely correct. So there is a huge backlog of everything that hasn't been heard for the last 6 months. So we need to catch up on all of those cases, the cases that were pending at the time of the shutdown. The cases that have been filed since the shutdown need to be heard. And there are constantly new cases coming in. And there's a huge backlog of cases that could or should have been filed during the shutdown that will now need to be filed. So I think the courts are really going to be inundated with proceedings trying to catch up.
Betsy Kramer is an attorney and director of policy and special litigation at Lawyers for Children. And John Kelly is a senior editor at The Imprint. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And you can find all of our stories in the series about how COVID-19 has affected our nation's judicial system at thetakeaway.org/justicedelayed. They're banks that most Americans do business with for everything from savings account to mortgages. Many, like JPMorgan Chase, HSBC, and Deutsche Bank, are household names. But a new investigation from BuzzFeed News and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists alleges that many of these same banks have a shadow financial system, where the money used to fund illegal activity from organized crime groups to terrorist organizations has been allowed to flourish. The investigation alleges that many of these banks, as well as the United States government, have done little to nothing to stop these transactions. And while many Americans may feel removed from issues involving big banks and so-called dirty money, our next guest says that what these banks do could have implications on our everyday lives. Anthony Cormier is a senior investigative reporter with BuzzFeed News, and he joins me now. Anthony, thank you for being with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
So bank employees are supposed to look for suspicious activity, and in almost all of these cases, they did their jobs. They filed suspicious activity reports. Where did those reports go, and what happened?
Right. So every bank has to, transacts in U.S. dollars, when they note suspicious behavior, they're supposed to send it to a department inside the Treasury called the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And those folks are the ones that keep this sort of vast database of all of these reports from around the globe of transactions that bear the hallmarks of money laundering or other kinds of financial crime.
So is this a question of folks who are doing their jobs, reporting suspicious activity, and then maybe folks who are higher up the managerial chain inside of these banks ignoring that suspicious activity? Or did the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network ignore that? What did your investigation find?
I think you've got both issues here, right? You've got these folks who are filing the reports as they should. And we don't see is the banks cutting off those suspicious clients. So for instance, I'll use Paul Manafort. JP Morgan Chase allowed Paul Manafort to send or receive millions of dollars and flagged his accounts at least 8 times. We see this again and again. We saw HSBC Hong Kong with clients who they deemed suspicious 12 times or 8 times. So we know that the compliance officials are flagging them, and but the bank executives are not cutting off the accounts. From the flip side, from the government's view, they're sitting on all of these records and they don't have enough staff to frankly read them all. And what our investigation found is they're not taking action when they read these reports, when they get these issues.
Now, what's behind that? I mean, if they know that this is an issue that's happening, it's clearly not supposed to happen. Why aren't they taking action?
Well, it's a really complicated issue. I think the Justice Department says that their best course of action is this kind of deal with the corporate entities, banks, called the Deferred Prosecution Agreement. They feel that they can best get these banks or corporate, actors in line by forcing them to change their ways. They don't prosecute the executives. They don't take individuals or hold the individuals accountable. They're forcing them to pay fines and to sort of clean up their compliance departments.
Anthony, we're talking about your investigation found about $2 trillion, that's trillion with a T, $2 trillion that have circulated through these banks, both globally and domestically, right?
Correct, yes. And that's, to be fair, a small window into a much larger system. Now, very few SARs or suspicious activity reports have ever been made public before. We have about 2,100. But consider that last year, FinCEN received 2 million of these reports. So if our 2,100 flagged $2 trillion, imagine the figure on 2 million of these reports a year.
And of course, those reports were leaked to you, correct?
They were disclosed to BuzzFeed News.
Got it. Anthony, you know, this is something when a lot of Americans hear with $2 trillion circulating around the globe with all sorts of unsavory characters and big banks, like they kind of feel, I think, like most of us, like, well, what does that have to do with me? But your reporting shows that it does have real life consequences for everyday folk who have regular accounts and regular lives. So what effect, how do you make that connection between what's happening in this big dark money world and what's happening with the average everyday Americans?
Absolutely. We reckoned with this in throughout the course of the reporting. And, you know, money laundering is a crime that makes other crimes possible. It accelerates economic inequality, it drains public funds, it undermines democracy, it destabilizes nations. The banks are playing a huge role in this. And what we found is that these transactions are showing up in the sort of world that we all live in. We found suspicious payments flowing into international sports and Hollywood entertainment, luxury real estate, sushi restaurants, you know, the gas that you put in your car, even the granola that you might put in your cereal or your yogurt.
So, Anthony, I mean, the big question, I guess, now is what happens next? Have politicians responded? Has FinCEN responded to this?
Well, FinCEN issued a rather unusual statement a couple of weeks before we published when we first approached them with our questions. They said they were going to refer the matter to the Justice Department. But the banks have not been able to comment to us on these reports. They're saying that in large part that they can't comment on these types of reports. The market has responded. And we've heard this week politicians respond as well. I thought Senator Liz Warren put out a very powerful statement suggesting that the system needs reform or overhaul. We'll see where that goes, and we're going to keep reporting until the end, frankly.
You said that the banks have not responded. Have they said anything about what's happened so far?
You know, quite a lot. I mean, I think they've said that they're acting in good faith and that they are trying to stem the tide of suspicious activity and in fairness to the banks. It's important to note that the criminals act very quickly and are very agile, and the schemes that they're using to filter the money into the banks are rapidly changing. So on a day-to-day basis, these banks are facing an enormous task. They've got to be smarter than the criminals. They've got to know what the latest scheme is. And I think it's important to note that they are they're trying to pivot all of the time to catch up with the criminal networks.
Well, we'll be watching. Anthony Cormier is a senior investigative reporter with BuzzFeed News, and you can read the full investigation on BuzzFeed.com. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This week, the United States hit a devastating milestone. At least 200,000 people have died from COVID-19 in this country since the pandemic began. And with the difficulty in tracking the scope of the virus, especially early on, the real toll could be even higher than the official number. It was back in May that the death toll surpassed 100,000 people, and with no national recognition of that mark, no official collective grieving day or day of remembrance, it felt like we as a country never really came together to mourn and acknowledge the scope and the scale of the crisis and of the people that we've lost. So we're going to keep talking about and honoring those who've been lost to COVID-19 on the show, and we're going to keep hearing from you about personal losses to the virus and how you'd like to see your loved ones remembered.
This is Elizabeth in Bothell, and I lost my brother in April, not due to the virus directly, but the effects of the disruption to life as a result of the virus. And what I would want the world to remember about him is everything else that came before the way he ended, which is that he was brilliant and devoted and funny and a loving brother, son, and father. That's what I would want people to remember.
I'm calling from Corpus Christi, Texas. My grandfather fell and hit his head. The brain bleeding was so bad that they had to take a chunk of his skull off to take the pressure down. While his immune system was suppressed from the surgery, he caught COVID, and it killed him. I want the world to remember that my grandpa was so tough, it took a hole in his head and a world-class pandemic to take him down.
Hi, this is Ricky from Miramar, calling for remembrance of my friend Dwayne Ellis. He died in the early days of COVID when we didn't really know what this was about. He had a heart disease, he died in March. Great guy. One of my best friends. Going to miss him. Going to miss his smile. Going to miss the way he told stories and the good times we had. Dwayne Ellis, love you. I miss you. From your friend Ricky in Miramar.
This is Luke McDonald calling from San Jose, California. I recently lost my grandmother to COVID. She was about to turn 97 and had all her mental capacities and was planning on living over 100. She even told me that, you know, as you get that age, you appreciate every year. And she survived 2 weeks and passed away in her sleep on a nap and just before her birthday. The 97th birthday, and she will be missed. She had a lifelong giving back to the community as a nurse, and even after she retired, she worked as a nurse in the juvenile facility and helped people out, and everybody loved her and had so many people there for her.
Hi, my name is Kim. I'm from Orlando, and our family lost our cousin. He is survived by both his parents, his six siblings, and his son. And he reminded me of just being a beautiful person. He was a fantastic person through and through.
Tom from Glendale. If you want a poster of the current member of the White House, it should be a man overlooking a field with 200,000 white crosses. I've lost 3 friends and know 10 people that have died. It is an abomination.
I always appreciate our listeners, and thank you for calling to share your stories with us. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. That's 877-869-8253. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
President Trump has said he will announce his nominee to replace Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg this Saturday. In order for that nomination to be stopped, there are four Republican senators who would have to vote against it. Senator Susan Collins is one of them. And Collins is facing a contentious Senate race in Maine where she said she would oppose the nomination. And hers is just a handful of races that could be deeply affected by Ginsburg's death. For more, I'm joined by Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Steve, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
What makes Senator Collins' race different from other Senate races across the country right now, Steve?
Well, I think for Senator Collins, her race has already had a bit of a judicial appointment imprint put on it because in 2018, she was a key vote to confirm Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And that vote marked, I think, you can almost draw a straight line from that vote to where she is right now, which is in a very precarious position, and she's in the fight of her life. Collins, for years, has always been self-identified as a pro-choice candidate, and that stance is part of the reason why she was always, her coalition has always been Democrats, independents, and Republicans. But since then, what we've seen is a deterioration of that coalition to the point where she's running neck and neck or behind, according to some polls, to her Democratic challenger, Sarah Gideon. And so this, you know, the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has only intensified that imprint, if you will. And so she's, regardless of what she said yesterday, which is that she will not vote no if a confirmation vote comes before Election Day, that may not help her all that much. In fact, what we're seeing now is that she's getting a lot of pressure from the right, including the president.
What's interesting, you mentioned her vote for Brett Kavanaugh. While many folks were hoping that she would vote against Kavanaugh's appointment, Senator Collins, as you mentioned, faces a really tough reelection campaign. She's 12 points behind her Democratic challenger. I mean, is it cynical to say that she's making this a political calculation rather than one of what some would expect would be moral courage?
Well, there's certainly a lot of cynics who believe that. Let's put it that way. I mean, she's been criticized before, especially during the Trump era, where this middle ground where she likes to operate has really shrunk beneath her feet. I mean, on the left, there's a lot of demands to resist the president, and on the right, there's demands for fealty to the president. And so, you know, what she did yesterday was looked at with a lot of skepticism from the left because, Mitt Romney had already announced that he will vote to confirm a justice, regardless of when it is. And so did several other potential swing votes. I mean, it's really just Senator Collins and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. And so she came out and clarified a statement she had released on Saturday, which kind of left the door open and left a lot of questions about what she would do if the Senate did rush a vote. And so when she came out yesterday, those four senators that you mentioned, four Republican senators, had already been accounted for. They're not there. So her vote at the end, a no vote, may not matter all that much. And I don't know that her position is going to necessarily help her with the center-left coalition that she may have already lost.
Steve, we've got about a minute left, or less than a minute left, but just curious how Mainers are thinking about this right now, because the polls don't look pretty good for Collins.
Yeah, I think Mainers in general they're divided. I mean, she did, again, during the Kavanaugh vote, she took a lot of pressure from the right, but also a lot of it from the left. And my impression is that the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, again, that the Kavanaugh vote was always an imprint on the race. And this has really just reanimated that impression. And I think it'll carry through on Election Day. People are going to have it top of mind, especially as these confirmation hearings go forward.
Steve Missler is chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now we're going to zoom out and look at how some other races are being affected, including how Democrats have seen a huge surge in donations over the past few days. Joining me now is Shane Goldmacher, national political reporter at the New York Times. Shane, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
So we just talked a little bit about Maine in the previous segment, but what other races are most affected by the shakeup in the court?
I'm not sure that there's a major Senate race that hasn't seen an impact from the court shakeup. For the court vacancy, all across the country, Democratic Senate candidates have seen really unprecedented infusion of cash from small donors that came in organically in the hours after Justice Ginsburg passed away and Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, announced that there would be a floor vote on whomever President Trump will appoint later this week. You know, I've talked to Democratic strategists from Alaska, which was really a completely off-the-map race, to some of the most heated races. We're talking multi-million dollars in most of these contests out of basically nowhere at the home stretch, huge infusions of money that's going to allow all of these Democratic candidates to buy more television ads, potentially hire more staff, run more digital spots. Doesn't mean they're going to win, but it absolutely shifted the landscape in an instant almost. Financially, at least, in the Democratic Party's favor.
And what is the connection there that people are trying to save? I mean, there's obviously concern that now that President Trump has indicated that he will try at least to appoint another Supreme Court justice before the election. How does that connect to what people are doing by trying to send cash to the Senate races, particularly the Democrats?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that for so many people, they know that, look, Donald Trump is going to pick his choice for the Supreme Court. And if the party, the Democratic Party, has any hopes of stopping that choice, it lies in the Senate, which has to confirm any nomination. And so there are a handful of swing senators who are up this year, people like Susan Collins, who you're just talking about, Lindsey Graham, who is the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, who will oversee any kind of a confirmation hearing, and they would like to put pressure on them and put pressure on them to not move forward, at least before the election. In Colorado, one of the other most vulnerable Republican senators is Cory Gardner. You know, put pressure on those senators and then also potentially win back the Senate. And so make it politically tougher for the Republicans to confirm someone if the calendar drags past November 3rd in terms of confirmation process. Imagine this, right? Joe Biden wins the presidency. Senate Democrats take control of the majority on November 3rd or in the days after, as we probably understand that the election result may not in fact come on November 3rd, but Democrats take control of the Senate. And then the Republicans confirm a Supreme Court justice. That's a real political pickle for the Republican Party. And so Democrats want to put them in that kind of a pickle. And really, you know, I cover money in politics for the New York Times. I've never seen anything quite like this. In the 4 days after Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, ActBlue, which is this website that processes most donations that are made online to political candidates on the left, saw $200 million in campaign contributions. That's about $130 million more than the previous four-day period. So this is just an enormous windfall of money.
Like you mentioned ActBlue. I was going to ask you exactly what was the catalyst for that, because generally speaking, the Democratic Party has sort of, at least from our perspective, has lagged a little bit in terms of galvanizing its voter base to really think about the Supreme Court. Has that shifted because of the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
This is the hope of Democratic Party strategists, that this money is a sign that the Democratic base cares more about Supreme Court vacancies than they have in the past. This has been a Republican issue to motivate Republican voters. Donald Trump famously in 2016 put out a list of specific justices he would pick if he became president, because the right was so skeptical of this guy who had, you know, been married three times, was a former Democrat, had been pro-choice, you know, now was saying, he was telling the world he was pro-life. You know, the Supreme Court is a galvanizing issue for the right and has been for a long time. But look, the possibility of the Supreme Court tilting to a 6-3 conservative majority with, you know, major things up for grabs, including Roe v. Wade, I think has the potential to galvanize the left.
Now, we sort of touched on this earlier, and I know we can't make any predictions here, but what would it take, Shane, for Democrats to actually win the Senate? I mean, this is, you know, there's money, but you mentioned that this could also be, you know, just a pressure point to put, particularly on senators like Collins and Gardner. Is this actually, could this turn into actual votes?
The Democrats could absolutely win the Senate in November. There are more than enough seats that they can win. There's probably three seats that they are favored to win at this point, and they only need to win four to take the majority. That said, it is not clear that galvanizing both parties through a Supreme Court vacancy in the days before an election will be a net benefit for the Democratic Party. A lot of the seats that the Democrats want to win and need to win to take a majority were carried by President Trump in 2016. States like Iowa, Georgia, South Carolina, these are places where if everybody just puts on the red jersey, if voters see the Republican senator and President Trump as part of defending a court seat, it's bad for the Democrats because in a lot of those places, they're running ahead of the Republican senator compared to the president. They need to be differentiated from President Trump. They want somebody to pick President Trump at the top and pick the Democratic Senate candidate because they like them better down ballot. That gets harder in a lot of those states. One of the other ones I didn't mention, Montana, popular Democratic governor running, could win that seat from a Republican. This is a state that Donald Trump won by 20 percentage points. If the Democratic nominee, Steve Bullock, is going to win, he has to do better than the average Democrat. He has to do better than Joe Biden. And so making a hyper-partisan, polarized electorate with a big Supreme Court fight, even with all this money, may not help.
Shane Goldmacher is a national political reporter at the New York Times. Shane, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lies in repose today and tomorrow at the U.S. Supreme Court building. And on Friday, she will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. She is the first woman ever to be given this honor. All this week, we've been looking back at the life and legacy of Justice Ginsburg, and we'll continue that today. In 1993, when President Bill Clinton nominated Justice Ginsburg to the Supreme Court, he referred to her as, quote, the Thurgood Marshall of gender equality law. But Ginsburg herself sometimes pushed back on the comparison to Marshall and his trailblazing civil rights work.
I'll take this opportunity to say I don't like the comparison of me to Thurgood Marshall because my life was never in danger. His was. He went to his southern town in the morning. He couldn't be sure he'd be alive at the end of the day. I never had that kind of threat.
That was Justice Ginsburg speaking in 2018. While much of Ginsburg's legal work indicated clear understandings of racial discrimination, some critics have called out some of her more personal shortcomings when it came to race. For example, like most of her male colleagues on the bench, she hired few law clerks who were Black or people of color. Joining me now is Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center. Fatima, thanks for being with me.
Glad to be with you.
So how did racial equality factor into some of Justice Ginsburg's early legal work?
One of the things that I think few people know is when she was at the ACLU Women's Rights Project, she actually filed a really important brief in the court in a case involving whether or not there should be the death penalty for rape. And she really used that case and that brief to highlight both the race tropes around sexual violence for Black men and also the way in which notions of purity that have been attached to white women, that they actually are harmful to white women and to everyone. And so, you know, one of the things that I think may seem more quiet and subtle about her work is that she got pretty clearly the idea that we were all harmed by discrimination. We were all harmed by whatever form it took, whether it was racism, sexism, disability discrimination. That is a through line throughout her work.
And yesterday on the show, well, we've been unpacking her legacy all week this week. And yesterday we talked a little bit about how she became a pop culture icon in a lot of ways. And some of that was really because of her dissent in the 2013 Shelby County case, which effectively dismantled key parts of the Voting Rights Act. Why do you think, Fatima, that that dissent struck such a chord?
So the dissent was important for a couple of reasons. It was important because of the terms that she used to highlight the absurdity of the majority's opinion, the absurdity of making it so the Voting Rights Act lost its teeth, right? And she was sort of funny in that opinion. She used analogies and said, you know, if it is raining and you are dry because you have an umbrella, now is not the time to take away your umbrella. It is still raining. And so I actually think one of the things that is very relatable about her opinions is that she goes back to the reality of people's lives, the ways things work in the real world. And for that, I think people thought, wow, she's standing up for everyone, and the cultural work continued forward.
So there have been some critiques, and of course, no one is able to get away without having a record critique, particularly if you're a Supreme Court justice. That comes with the territory. But I wonder, Fatima, if you can tell us a little bit about, you know, how we should be looking at the standards, I think, that many, quote unquote, progressive icons are held to. Some folks have criticized her for not hiring enough Black law clerks, for example. She called in 2016, called Colin Kaepernick's decision to take a knee, quote unquote, dumb, which she later apologized for. So were these human error or, you know, sort of missteps, or were they part of a larger impossible standard that a lot of our progressive icons are held to?
You know, I think it's important to separate the Kaepernick from the hiring, because I think she apologized once she learned more, right? And that was important. Once she understood what the protest was about and why it was happening, she basically said, I shouldn't have commented. I didn't know enough. My apologies there. But on the hiring front, that is a thing that I think we have to explore and talk about. The Supreme Court bar is a bar that remains still in 2020, mostly white, mostly male, and the sort of elite echelons of the legal profession, clerkships being one of them, there are very few people of color that do clerk, let alone Black people who do clerk. You know, when 20 years ago, when I clerked in the Seventh Circuit, I was one of two Black clerks on the whole court at that time. And you would think that it had gotten dramatically better, and that is not the case. So some of that deals with the diversity of the people who are in those roles, but some of it deals with breaking up the sort of systems that make it so only a few people even get close to having that sort of opportunity. It's bad for this country.
When we look at how race has played out on the Supreme Court itself, we know that there are only two people of color, one Black sitting judge and one Puerto Rican sitting Supreme Court justice right now, and that is Sonia Sotomayor at the moment. And she has, in many of her opinions, at least directly called out race, including at one point calling out microaggressions in some of her dissents. So will Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, be sort of carrying the mantle further for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or is she really carving out her own path when it comes to calling out America, the United States' systemic racial inequities here as a justice of color?
You know, I think Justice Sotomayor's role on the bench highlights why we need a really diverse bench, because she raises issues that aren't raised. That is true on race. That is true on gender. And that is true because she can talk about the community she came from, the experiences she's had in her life. But one of the things that she also has done is she has remained connected to community. When she wrote her book, she had meetings where she sort of talked about her life and her personal story. The Supreme Court shouldn't be in an ivory tower making decisions and totally disconnected from real people. And it gives me great confidence that she is on the court.
And now there are many calls to have a Black woman as the nominee for the next Supreme Court justice. Fatima, we've got less than a minute to go, but is that even a likelihood if, say, Joe Biden wins the presidency?
Well, Joe Biden has committed to appointing a Black woman to the Supreme Court. So my guess is that will happen if he wins. But I just want to add that it is this current process for Justice Ginsburg's seat is far, far from done. It is an extraordinary idea that during an election that they would rush this nomination through. And I think people are going to rise up and try to stop this current process as well.
We're already seeing some of that in some key Senate races across the country. Fatima Goss-Graves is the president of the National Women's Law Center. Thank you so much, Fatima.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing your stories with us. We really appreciate that. And please continue to call in and share your stories with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-865-8253. You can also send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. It's at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.